Welcome to the Art Scene, presented each week by UALR Public Radio. Hendricks College in Conway has a wonderful tradition in the theatre department, where each spring a guest director is in residence for several weeks, working with students on the play of choice, suggested by the director and approved by the department. This year, Melora Cordos is here. The play chosen is Shakespeare's Measure for Measure. Chicago-born Melora grew up in a theatrical family. An exceptionally fine high school laid the groundwork for what has become her career.
After undergrad, started working as an actress, and I was getting decent work, but I felt I had plateaued after a while, and I wasn't getting the regional work that I wanted. And I remember deciding I needed to figure out what it was that everyone else who was getting work in the theaters I wanted to work at was doing that I wasn't doing. And one day I was at a show and I started reading the playbill, reading all the bios, and I realized that every single person in that cast had their master's degree. Okay, so I did. And that's what moved me to D.C. I decided to get, if I was going to focus, my focus was going to be on classical theater. So I got my MFA from the ACE, it's a long title, the Academy for Classical Acting at the Shakespeare Theater through George Washington University. I'd done a few Shakespeare shows before then, and I understood some, but I knew I didn't really grasp what it was to perform the classics well and why. And I needed that training. I needed that understanding. And my training then in my MFA really did open that world up and explained and trained and showed me so much. And then, exactly like I thought, as soon as I graduated, now I'm getting work at all the regional theaters and all the places, and I'm getting calls for auditions up in New York. That changed the world for me.
Did you find that as a result of what you'd gone through, that Shakespeare became very important for you? You wanted to do more of it?
Yes. Yes, extremely so. I'd always loved Shakespeare. I always loved the stories. I was terrified of the verse. I didn't quite understand the rules of verse, and I didn't understand rhetoric. And once I went back and I learned and I got trained, it became so much more evident to me just how important this work is, these characters are, these stories are. They're the penultimate stories, the most extreme situations and characters, and there is nothing grander.
But looking at this play, have you done or acted in Measure for Measure before?
I had not, and so I was very excited when I got this opportunity. One of my bucket list goals is to do every play in the canon, either act in it or direct in it. I'm fine with a combination of both. And I think right now, out of all the titles, I have 18 under my belt. I have numerous duplicate productions, but 18 separate titles. And so when Hendricks had interviewed me and we sat and discussed what show to do this season and they wanted to do a Shakespeare, and I asked me if I had any that I was particularly interested in doing. And so, of course, I want to pick one of the ones I haven't done yet. And when I mentioned Measure for Measure, Danny Grace immediately, you know, started glowing. Oh, that's on his list, too, of shows he hasn't done and has wanted to do. And Anne Muse was very excited about it. And I think we all immediately agreed this would be a fantastic show.
What did you find out about it?
Well, I did know it, actually, fairly well. I've seen three productions in my life of it. Worked on scenes. I've done some research. In my schooling days, I've written a couple papers. So been familiar with the text, not from a directorial standpoint, of course. But the thing that I love about this play that I think in our contemporary culture, at least in America, productions tend to gravitate to the dark, twisted side of the story, and it becomes this heavy, sort of scary, frightening piece. And it's actually one of the comedies. It's listed in the folio under comedies. And it is funny. The situation that the Duke sets us up with at the top of the play is ridiculous. He creates this completely convoluted story and series of events that actually don't need to happen. And it's once we meet Angelo and Isabella together and the corruption steps in and we start to see. So we have these moments of depravity and these moments of greed and power and lust, which are, of course, very powerful. You know, it's what Shakespeare's so wonderful at, writing the human character and all of its glorious flaws. Sort of through line that keeps us through is very humorous, not just with our mechanicals and some of our other fun characters, but even the Duke, who is, he actually is the star of the show. He is almost never off stage. He's sort of orchestrating most of what's going on. We're embracing the flaws, and of course this is a problem play. One of the problems being we're dealing with very dark, twisted subject matter, but also in a humorous light. The students and I are having a lot of fun discovering these characters and flushing them out and really creating this wonderful world. And we're setting this in the Regency era. And of course, it's in Vienna, but the rules of society still for the Regency era are very much at play. And of course, politics, corruption, women's place in society that we're all fighting against. And of course, this has very, very strong feminist themes in this play that we deal with. So I felt that this illuminated, this setting it in this era helped illuminate a lot of the themes and the struggles that our contemporary audience would easily grasp and understand.
Now, the leading female is a novitiate, isn't she?
Yes.
Trying to be a nun?
Yes, she's just about to take her vows when her world crumbles.
Doesn't Shakespeare use names for the various characters that are fairly descriptive of what their morals are?
Oh, very much so. I mean, our Mistress Overdone is our brothel mistress. And of course, you know, Angelo, who is our devil in disguise as an angel. Elbow, our constable, lifting his elbow.
So the play itself isn't done all that often.
It's not.
Are there weaknesses in it that you've discovered as to why this doesn't hit the boards as lightly or as interestingly as so many of Shakespeare's plays do?
Yes. One of what is referred to as his problem plays.
Mm-hmm.
And for a number of reasons. One is the sort of incongruity of the comedy and drama that most people want to categorize it as a drama, but it really is a comedy. And of course, the ending, which I'm not going to give away, but a very strange proclamation by the Duke in the last two lines of the play, which comes out of nowhere and makes no sense. And I've decided in this production, we actually cut that because it undermined everything that was written in the text up to that point, the characters that were developed. I'm a traditionalist. I will not change Shakespeare's words.
If you're interested, the one or two things that I scribbled down after reading barely three pages of Bloom, that Shakespeare's farewell to comedy, but he says it's a play so savagely bitter as to be unmatched with Twelfth Night.
I agree. I absolutely agree. Because it does have dark undertones, and mm-hmm. It's not a light romp. It's in no way, Twelfth Night has some depth, but again, love stories, the bad things that happen aren't so bad. But in Measure for Measure, morals and eternal damnation is at stake.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a penalty of death. And even the, you know, and all of our characters within the play refer to it going, are you kidding me? For you know, a quick trick, for something that's fun, that's natural, that everybody does. We're going to die for this? But Angelo just, no, it is death. And yeah, that's...
Are the students enjoying it?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. And they keep making new discoveries and scenes about their character or the storyline and the world. And they're really embracing it and enjoying playing and having fun and creating this world and the situation that they all find themselves in. Truly, in the last two lines of the play, to be thrown this 180 giant curveball and then, hey, play's over, and no text to deal with it. And of course, I'm a firm believer that if the text doesn't support it, you can't make that choice. You can have as much creative leeway as you want and make choices, but the text has to support it in some way. You can't change the text to make it support it.
And so if you remove the last bit, it left with a more satisfying ending?
Yes, very much so.
That was Melora Cordos, the 2016 Director in Residence in the Hendrix College Theatre Arts Department. Measure for Measure by William Shakespeare opens Wednesday, February the 24th, with performances 24th through 27th at 7:30. For tickets, call 1-501-450-1343 or online hendrix.edu/theatre. THEATRE Arts. The Arkansas Symphony's fifth Masterworks Concert presents one of the greatest choral works of all time, The German Requiem by Johannes Brahms, preceded by Leonard Bernstein's Chichester Psalms, new to many of us, perhaps, such as I, which adds to the anticipation. There are two soloists in the Brahms, baritone Robert Holden and soprano Maria Fasciano, accompanied by seven choirs. One soloist, a countertenor, in the Bernstein. Today, Robert is my guest. He grew up in Philadelphia into an athletic family. One of five boys. An older brother sang, so he did too. One of five boys. An older brother sang, so he did too. But played all sports until injury cut short football stardom. A grandfather played for the Philadelphia Phillies, so he stayed in music.
My first year of college was at Westminster Choir College in Princeton, New Jersey.
And, good school.
Yes, it is a very good school and wonderful experiences there. And
well, that would have given you a chance to hear other than church music. You've got a lot of choral experience in your background. Did you go into oratorio and the training and repertoire of that style of beginning part of a chorus and then climbing the ladder into solo parts ahead of opera?
Very much so. I was an opera hater, did not like opera at all. I was actually a folk singer. I did a lot of original music and I play guitar and I had recorded an album and was working on a second one and was traveling around the country singing in coffee houses and concerts and that kind of thing, and started taking voice lessons from a man in New Hampshire. And he told me, you know, I really like your folk singing. He said, you're one of the best I've heard, but there's a lot more voice in there than just folk music, and you ought to think about opera. I was married by that time, and I went home and told my wife, I think I might be becoming an opera singer. And she said, you hate opera. And I said, yeah, but I think this might be something that I might be able to do. And so that was the beginning. That was the start of it.
So did the beginning be the first opera you went to see and enjoy, or the repertoire that this teacher that you found, was he the one who advised you to... Who told you this in the first place, or did he recommend a teacher?
No, he was the teacher that really kind of built my voice at that point. And I worked with him for about 4 years.
So what did he do?
It was rather different because he taught me unlike anyone else that he had taught before. He had put me in touch with a couple of books, one by Jerome Hines, one by Pavarotti. I had read the Pavarotti book because I really liked listening to him sing. And I said to him, you know, it seems like Pavarotti did just vocal exercises on vowels and not any repertoire for a while. And he said, you know, I've been wanting to try that. And he said, you're a perfect guinea pig for this. So because it was a small music program that I was part of, he said, I'm going to waive all of your requirements for juries for the first year, and all we're going to do is exercises if you'll go along with me on that. Yeah. And so he waived all of those requirements for me for the first year, and that's all we did is we worked on vowels for for a year.
So then you go put your toe in the water and go to see an opera, listen to the voice in whatever role that will be possibly the one that you might be looking for. Mm-hmm. And is that what you did? And what did you think?
Actually, the first thing that I had done was listen to recording of Tosca by Puccini. He gave me that to listen to. And I read through the libretto as I was listening to it. It was a recording with Pavarotti, Cheryl Milnes, and Mirella Freni. Not a bad cast to listen to your first opera. As much as I loved the music, I was really drawn in by the drama. That started to get its hooks into me. And that really is what took over and really built a love for me for opera.
So you were with him for about 4 years. Mm-hmm. Had you already started looking at how you could get into performing in an opera?
I did. And actually, I performed in a few operas in New Hampshire, even while I was going to school in New Hampshire and in Massachusetts, the Boston area.
So coming into it, did you still keep up with joining choral oratorio, or did you just concentrate on opera for a while?
I concentrated on opera mostly. I did sing oratorio, but usually as the soloist, you know, I would sing at Messiah Sings, and I would occasionally do other things. I did a Lord Nelson Mass and by Haydn, and did some other things, small things around the area.
Now, were you based pretty much near home, or had you started to move across the country to different places?
At that point, I had moved to New England and had lived there, and that was considered home for me, and performed mostly in that area while I was still in undergrad and then graduate school.
So your paths stretched further afield after a while.
It sure did, yeah.
And was that, did you have to go into the service and do things like that?
No.
So what took you that ended up here in the South?
That is a long, circuitous route.
In words of one syllable.
Exactly right. I did my master's degree under John Moriarty at Boston Conservatory in the mid-80s. And then from that point, I started bridging out not only across the country, but into Europe as well.
And languages were all part of that development.
Sure, yeah. Yes. And fortunately, I had a bit of an ear for languages. I was required through my graduate year to take at least a year of college language in each, Italian, German, and French. German seemed to suit me the best of all three of them as far as language was concerned.
There are a lot of words that have a similarity to English, and particularly when you're doing something that has a religious text, the English and German are almost
very much easy
to understand anyway.
Very much yes, so, yeah.
So with that behind you, or in the midst of, and the connections you've obviously been making with the places you've been in, you still kept up with the oratorio?
Absolutely. Yeah. I've sung. I love oratorio. I love Handel's works. I've done many of Handel's works. I've done, surprisingly enough, I've done quite a number of Carmina Burana's. My teacher in Austria coached the Carmina Burana with Orff. So as I coached it with him, I was really getting the words from the horse's mouth, as it were.
Exactly.
But that's been a favorite of mine. Elijah has been a particular favorite.
I loved Elijah.
And the one piece that I've done more than any of the others, including the Messiah, has been the Brahms Requiem.
The way Brahms writes music for the voice is extraordinary. Mm. His music asks to be sung. Mm-hmm. I imagine you probably rely more on your opera production vocally.
Yeah.
So when you first sang the Brahms Requiem, did you find sort of automatically you were absorbing it almost like a role?
Yes, to a certain extent. Yes, that's true.
So when you sang Brahms for the first time, was it in the chorus or as a soloist?
Strangely enough, that is the one oratorio that I've not sung the chorus to at all. I've always been the soloist in the Brahms, and I love the choral pieces, and often I'll be sitting there and singing them in my head while I'm sitting out front and can't sing because I love the work so much.
And in the vernacular, as opposed to the Latin, which most masses up until that point had been
right.
drawing on because that was the original tradition,
mm-hmm.
did it prove more challenging to sing, to get into with a text of that nature?
Well, obviously German and English are harder to sing in some ways than Latin or Italian. Those seem to be languages that are so laden with vowels. With the Brahms, for some reason, it just sets right in the voice. The text is set so well.
Wow.
Indeed.
And it becomes more a personal thing.
Sure. The Brahms Requiem allows me to be personal. It allows me to be me rather than some character. And so I'm able to express my feelings, my personal emotions and feelings about this. And so certainly as I grow older and experience more things, children, grandchildren, the loss of loved ones and friends, that all speaks to how I approach this. And yet I can be very personal with it as well, which is, for me, very exciting. It's not putting myself in another character and having some aspects of me in that, but this is completely and utterly my feelings towards all of this. And that makes it very rewarding and very exciting.
Baritone Robert Holden, who will be joined by soprano Maria Fasciano, soloists in Brahms' Deutsche Requiem with the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra and 7 choirs. The Requiem is one of 2 works. The concert includes Chichester Psalms by Leonard Bernstein, also with choir but only one, with 1 soloist, countertenor Ray Chenet. We had to record Ray Chenet in France. Skype came to the rescue, where he was rehearsing an early Baroque opera. He was born and raised in Lockport, New York, and all his early training was in the United States. He was clearly happy to talk about his life so far and where it seems to be taking him. He made his debut in Lincoln Center last season and is full of praise for the way 21st century directors are looking back to the 16th century and earlier and is delighted to be part of this exploration. He also loves Mozart.
The main thing that caught my interest in regards to singing was musical theater. And when I was 12 years old or so, I auditioned for the school musical when I was in middle school. And at that point, I was really encouraged to sing. And that's how it all started for me. And I think I was attracted to the theater initially. Mm-hmm. And then I found out that I could sing as well. So I sort of married the two. And since then, it's always, you know, really been my passion to sing and create theater.
So you can do both in opera.
Exactly.
But did you have a regular tenor voice at this point when you started your theater staging?
Well, my voice hadn't changed at that time. So I had sort of a boy soprano voice mm-hmm. at that time, but I never sang truly as a boy soprano or in a choir or anything like that. And after my voice changed, I did continue studies as a tenor.
Mm-hmm. And then you presumably had a teacher who heard something special?
That's exactly right, yes. My teacher at SUNY Fredonia, we were vocalizing one day in the studio, and I was very frustrated that I couldn't get into my top as a tenor. And I just started singing in head voice and we just kept going higher and higher and higher. And she said, well, you ought to just be a countertenor.
And you never really heard of anything like that, sort of maybe a style of falsetto?
people use lots of different terminologies to describe what a countertenor is. The way I describe it is singing in head voice, because just like female singers have a chest voice mm-hmm. and a head voice, mm-hmm. so do male singers. You know, we are all people. It's all the human voice. And those are sort of the two main methods of phonation are head voice and chest voice. And as a countertenor, I sing mostly in head voice.
And your head voice just goes considerably higher than a tenor would in a head voice. So did you go on with this teacher who heard you had a higher voice and a reason for being perhaps a countertenor? Or did she suggest that you go to another teacher to strengthen that style?
I studied with her throughout my undergraduate studies. I went to Florida State for graduate school after my undergraduate studies and studied there. And from there, I did start to do some competitions and things like that and started auditioning. Well, I think my voice is very similar to a mezzo-soprano voice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from the very beginning, I always was able to sing quite high. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I'm doing roles that so for me, it's quite normal to sing in that area.
Now, the repertoire that you're exploring or being asked to sing for, this would be unusual to go back to something by Da Vinci.
Ah, yes, Leonardo Vinci. Well, it's really quite amazing what projects are happening now in Europe. Many Baroque works that haven't been heard since their inception are now being revived for the first time. And it's really an exciting thing. And I think we're in a day and age of countertenors where there are now countertenors who can sing these very virtuosic and high castrati roles. And, you know, this is a relatively new phenomenon for this to be able to happen. And it's really exciting to see these pieces that are being pulled out again for the first time, that you really get to create again for the first time. And the audience hasn't seen them. And so it's a totally new experience. It's like doing a new opera in a way.
The role that you're going to be singing here at the Chichester Psalms, you mentioned boy soprano and originally written for a boy soprano.
That's correct, yes. It does say in the score, and Bernstein did write, or countertenor.
How often have you performed this?
I probably have performed this with maybe five or six different organizations. It's a Hebrew text. And they were written for the Chichester Cathedral.
Have you sung it in cathedrals?
I have. I've sung it in some churches in Tampa Bay, Florida, in Cleveland, and some other concert halls as well. Carnegie Hall, I've sung it.
Have you sung it in its place of origin, as you might say?
That I have not.
I'm looking forward to hearing it because it's totally new to me, and I imagine to a fair portion of the audience will be hearing you. Something special. Philip is very good at planning programs, and I hope that this will be something you will enjoy.
Oh, I'm certainly looking forward to it.
And that was Ray Chenet, countertenor and soloist in Leonard Bernstein's Chichester Psalms, which, along with Brahms' Deutsches Requiem, with soloist soprano Maria Fasciano and baritone Robert Holden, and seven area choirs, who join the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra under conductor Philip Mann, Saturday, February the 27th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday the 28th at 3 in the Mommel Performing Arts Center. For tickets, call 501-666-1761 or online, arkansasymphony.org. And now, an Art Up special, the second Arkansas Reps Weekend Extra, Joe Graves in An Iliad, not to be missed. 7 p.m., February the 24th through March the 5th. In the Reps Annex, 518 Main Street. For tickets, 501-378-0405 or therep.org. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR Public Radio.